KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
He's really taking a sledgehammer approach to U.S. foreign policy and the institutions around it.
President Trump has moved to aggressively scale back the U.S. role in the world based on his, quote, America First agenda.
For Thursday, May 1st, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilse Chang. The conclave to choose a new pope starts next week.
The Vatican says that sexual abuse is among the issues the cardinals are currently discussing.
Each one of these cardinals have dozens and dozens of priests in their diocese that have been known to abuse children. That's a fact. So what have they done with these cases?
Also, the state of Alabama now has two black members in its congressional delegation.
Voters there are embracing progress.
It's about fair representation, making sure you have someone that cares about your community. And to me, just being willing to go in the community.
And a review of Marvel's Thunderbolts
after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Department of Veterans Affairs has ended a mortgage rescue program for veterans. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports housing industry experts fear thousands of vets and their families will face foreclosure.
The Department of Veterans Affairs set up the VA Service Purchase Program, or VASP, to correct an error with the home loan program during the Biden administration that left tens of thousands of veterans facing foreclosure through no fault of their own. In the less than 6 months it was up and running, VA says VASP saved at least 17,000 veterans from losing their homes. But Republicans in Congress oppose VASP because it has VA buy up the troubled loans. There is a bill in the House to replace it with a different program, but there's no saying when that might make it into law. The VA has now ended VASP despite groups like the Mortgage Bankers Association warning it would lead to thousands of foreclosures. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
A federal judge is barring the Trump administration from deporting any Venezuelans from South Texas under an 18th century wartime law the administration's been citing. U.S. District Court judge ruling in the case, the administration's invocation of the law itself is unlawful. Judge the first to rule the Alien Enemies Act cannot be used against people the administration claims are gang members invading the U.S. President Trump has cited the act using it as an extension of his executive powers. In the aftermath of World War II, President Harry Truman helped create and lead many institutions that still define the international order today. By contrast, the Trump administration is moving aggressively to scale back traditional U.S. leadership positions. Here's NPR's Greg Myrie.
In his first 100 days, Trump is acting on multiple fronts to reshape the U.S. role in the world. He says Europe should stop depending on U.S. troops for its security. He repeatedly criticizes allies and has threatened or imposed tariffs on many friendly countries. Kelly Grieco is with the Stimson Center, a nonpartisan think tank.
He's really taking a sledgehammer approach to U.S. foreign policy and the institutions around it.
Trump is often dismissive of institutions the U.S. helped build, including the United Nations and NATO. He describes this network of international bodies as obstacles that often prevent the U.S. from acting decisively on its own. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
An exemption that allowed some low-value imports from China to enter the U.S. duty-free officially comes to an end tomorrow. For consumers, that will likely mean higher prices, possibly combined with delivery delays. Under the so-called de minimis rule, as many as 4 million low-value parcels coming into the U.S. every day, mostly from China, had been exempted from duties. It means some companies that source products to China will face increased costs. Stocks closed mostly higher on Wall Street today. The Dow's up 83 points. The Nasdaq jumped 264 points. This is NPR. The White House says the minerals deal with Ukraine would create a fund governed by three board members from each country, where each country would receive half of royalties, license fees, and other proceeds from national resource projects in Ukraine. The U.S. will have first right of refusal on buying the resources or designating the buyer. That's according to a White House fact sheet. The agreement shows how invested the president is in securing a truly lasting peace, according to White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt, who spoke with reporters at the White House today. The deal would be part of an agreement for further U.S. support in Ukraine's war with Russia. The writer Kenesia Lubin has won this year's Carol Shields Prize. The awards honors women and non-binary fiction writers in the U.S. and Canada. NPR's Andrew Limbong has more.
Kinesia Lubrin is a Canadian writer known more for her poetry. Her debut fiction book, Code Noir, won her the prize, though. It's a collection of 59 connected short stories taking inspiration from French King Louis XIV's laws legalizing and regulating slavery in France and the French colonies. Judges for the Carol Shields Prize called it a, quote, virtuoso collection that breaks new ground in short fiction. The Carol Shields Prize for Fiction is relatively new, but it's made an impact on the literary world because of its sheer size. Winners get $150,000. In comparison, winners of the National Book Award receive $10,000. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices, after some recent downturns, moved in the other direction today. Oil was up a dollar, more than a dollar a barrel, to $59.24 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump's national security advisor, Mike Waltz, is out of the White House. The president said that he is nominating Waltz to be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And in the interim, Trump is replacing Waltz with Marco Rubio, who, by the way, will still also have the job of Secretary of State. This is the first major shakeup of Trump's second term. And for more, we're joined now by NPR's Asma Khalid, who's at the White House. Hi, Asma.
Hi there. It's good to speak with you.
Good to speak with you. Okay, so tell us more about what's behind the shakeup.
Mm-hmm. Well, Waltz had come under pressure the last several weeks. You probably recall back in March, The Atlantic magazine reported that Mike Waltz had accidentally invited its editor-in-chief to a private text message among Trump administration officials. Mm-hmm. They were on this text chain discussing plans for a military strike against the Houthis in Yemen. It went on to become a major storyline and frankly, an embarrassment for this administration. You know, and I will say this administration had not really dealt with the steady beat of staffing scandals it did in the early days of the Trump's first term. And I will say, broadly, it raised questions about the security and operation of this White House. A couple days after the incident, the president was asked directly who was responsible for this mistake, and here's how he responded.
Well, yeah, Mike Waltz, I guess he said he claimed responsibility, I would imagine. Had nothing to do with anyone else. It was Mike, I guess. I don't know. I was told it was Mike. But again, the attacks were unbelievably successful, and that's ultimately what you should be talking about, I think. So Mike took responsibility for it.
And so you heard there, Elsa, I mean, he publicly downplayed the incident. Yeah. He went on to blame the media for making this into a witch hunt. And he's been defending Waltz publicly. He said last week when he was asked about Mike Waltz's future that he is fine.
Okay, but obviously something changed, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, even as the president was publicly defending him, he was at the same time leaning more heavily on other top aides for national security issues, people like Steve Witkoff, his Middle East envoy, who he's also been working with on talks to end the war in Ukraine, as well as talks with Iran. Mm-hmm. Trump's also been leaning more heavily on his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. And in the context of all of this, I would also note that, you know, Waltz has a more traditional hawkish view of foreign policy than some of the other people in the White House around President Trump.
Okay, let me just make sure I understand what's going on with Rubio. He is now going to take up both the role of National Security Advisor while he is also Secretary of State. Is that right?
That is right. In a post this afternoon on his social media site, the president said that Rubio will have both jobs. And I will say this is extremely unusual. The last and only time someone held these two jobs simultaneously was Henry Kissinger in the Nixon administration in the early 1970s. Right. And Elsa, I will point out that this was not without controversy. And there are certainly questions about how this is going to work, even if it is just a short-term assignment? How will it work in practical terms? How long will Rubio be doing multiple jobs? I called up Katie Dunn-Tempest for some guidance. She's with the Brookings Institution, and she's researched White House staffing. She said that this is kind of similar to what Trump did in his first term.
So in term one, you might remember Mick Mulvaney was the director of the Office of Management and Budget, and Donald Trump also put him in charge of Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. It's highly unconventional, but is not unusual for the Trump administration, and I watched it during the first term, and I watched it with a great deal of awe because I had not seen it in prior administrations.
And so that's interesting, this idea, right, of people having multiple jobs, she said, is something she noticed during that first term. Also, in his first term, Trump struggled in particular to keep people in the national security role. He had four different national security advisors during those first 4 years.
Wow, that's right. Okay, so what happens now that Waltz is going to be the pick for ambassador to the UN?
Yeah, this job at the UN has been vacant for some time. The president's original pick, Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, the president asked her to stay in Congress to help with that slim Republican majority in the House. This UN job will require Senate confirmation, and Elsa, that is key, because we'll see if senators have concerns about the use of Mike Waltz's use of messaging apps for sensitive information. We'll see if that comes up during that confirmation process.
That is NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid. Thank you so much, Asma.
Nice to speak with you.
In the lead-up to Conclave, the Vatican says sexual abuse is among the issues cardinals are discussing this week, along with what qualities the new pope will need to face that challenge. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose reports from Rome that survivors are shining a spotlight on some cardinals they say have covered up abuse.
When she heard cardinals were talking about how the next pope would need to confront child sexual abuse, Sarah Pearson was heartened.
That's evidence that what survivors have been doing is working.
Pearson is with SNAP, the survivors network of those abused by priests. Her group has launched a project called Conclave Watch. It's a website that profiles various cardinals and outlines what those church leaders have done and left undone.
We're using their system to file these reports, but we're also taking the investigation outside of the hands of these Vatican officials and putting it in the hands of survivors.
Pope Francis' decree Vos Estis Lux Mundi allows any bishop or cardinal to be reported and investigated for abuse or cover-up. Conclave Watch includes the formal reports SNAP has sent to the Vatican, along with any supporting evidence they've gathered. Peter Isley is one of the group's founders. At age 13, he was sexually abused by a priest.
Each one of these cardinals have dozens and dozens of priests in their diocese that have been known to abuse children. That's a fact. So what have they done with these cases? People need to know their record.
Isley's encouraging cardinals to use the site to essentially research each other before they vote. In the U.S., the Catholic Church removes from ministry priests found guilty of abusing children, but that's not the case around the world. To change that disparity, Isley says Conclave Watch also includes a proposal for a new canon law written by both international human rights experts and canon lawyers. It would make the U.S. standard global.
We wanted to make sure that this law was properly written, that it met both the standards of international law and canon law,
and would help the church protect children. Back in 2019, church leaders rejected a similar proposal, saying it endangered innocent priests in areas hostile to Catholics. This week, around the Vatican, Isley and others from SNAP are handing out copies of that model legislation to cardinals as they prepare to elect the next leader of the Catholic Church. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Rome.
Thunderbolts is Marvel's latest team-building exercise. Critic Bob Mondello says that although it follows several Marvel misfires, it is an effective blend of misfit mercenaries and pop psychology.
Yelena, who we met a few years back as Black Widow's spiritual sibling, gets things started by being decidedly down in the depths.
There's something wrong with me.
Well, as the old Cole Porter song would have it, down in the depths on the 90th floor.
An emptiness.
She's standing on the roof of a skyscraper, looking glum.
I thought it started when my sister died, but now it feels like something bigger.
She steps towards the edge.
just a void.
And steps off, plummeting pretty clearly to her death since she doesn't fly. Then a billow of black fabric.
Or maybe I'm just bored.
And she's skydiving down to her latest assignment, something to do with destroying a lab in Malaysia. And it does bore her, even when things go right.
Boo.
Elena, played with downbeat charisma by Florence Pugh, is just not feeling fulfilled, and neither are the mostly unsuper superhero types she'll soon be tangling with in a life-or-death battle. Even diehard Marvel fans may not recognize them right away. Ghost, who can dematerialize to get herself out of jams, Taskmaster, who's a very good mimic, John Walker, who is, as Yelena puts it, a
dime store Captain America.
I'll have you know, I was actually the official Captain America, so.
Yeah, for like 2 seconds.
And
it's getting so tense in here.
This other guy.
Who are you?
I'm Bob.
Gotta say, I found him instantly relatable. Not sure why. All of these folks were damaged by childhood trauma, a fact that will be central to what follows, but that doesn't mean they can't put two and two together.
Someone wants us gone. Who sent you, Bob?
Were you all sent?
They were, and when they realize by whom, they head straight for the office of the impeached but unrepentant head of the CIA, played with delighted condescension by Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Look at you. You are all so adorable. Just think, I send you down there to kill each other, and instead, you make nice and you form a team.
The forming is what the movie's about. Bob, I'm pleased to say, turns out to have a lot to do with her nefarious schemes. Along for the ride is Yelena's dad.
You ever drive through Oklahoma? It's so flat.
He is both a limo driver and the self-styled Red Guardian.
She's bulletproof.
What happened to bulletproof?
It's bulletproof-ish.
Another old pal shows up who is Captain America adjacent.
Is that Bucky? It's a Winter Soldier.
That guy's so cool.
Cool, but also damaged in a film that takes bruised psyches seriously. That may seem odd for a superhero epic, but director Jake Schreier, who's probably best known for the Netflix road rage series Beef, makes sense of it. He and his team have built thunderbolts around pyrotechnics that are digital, sure, but also emotional.
You feel fulfilled?
Yeah, so full. So filled. But why do you ask this?
I'm just drifting, and I don't have purpose.
You could also say that about Marvel of late, and while it's not wise to read too much into character-based navel-gazing, after 36 movies, a bit of self-awareness sure is welcome. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Two majority black cities in Alabama now have black representation in Congress. It's the result of court-mandated redistricting. Black voters are embracing the progress at a time when the Trump administration is pulling back federal diversity efforts. NPR's Debbie Elliott has this story. It's part of our series looking at how President Trump's early actions are playing out across America.
Shalila Dowdy sits beneath a sprawling canopy of live oak trees in downtown Mobile's historic Bienville Square. She's one of the black voters who sued Alabama to have a bigger voice in Congress.
It's about fair representation. It's about just making sure you have someone that cares about your community. And to me, just being willing to go in the community and talk to the people.
The lawsuit made it to the U.S. Supreme Court, which agreed Alabama's congressional map discriminated against black voters in a state where African Americans make up about a quarter of the population. When the state legislature failed to create a new mostly black district, a federal court drew one that stretches across Alabama. It includes much of the majority black cities of Mobile on the Gulf Coast and Montgomery, the state capital. The new lines resulted in the election of a black Democrat, Representative Shamari Figures. So Alabama now has two black members of Congress out of its seven seats in the House of Representatives. Dowdy says it's made a difference.
In the past, I really never really saw my representative, my member of Congress.
Dowdy says she's already had a face-to-face meeting with the newly elected Figures and feels like she has a seat at the table for the first time. What she wants to talk about is what's happening in the Department of Defense. She's an Army veteran and a West Point graduate, upset that her alma mater has disbanded certain cultural clubs.
The Women's Engineering Club is no longer able to operate. The National Society of Black Engineers is no longer able to operate. We had a majority African American club that was kind of like our Black Student Union, but we called it Contemporary Affairs Seminar, no longer able to operate. So if three or more black students are gathered, it can look suspicious.
She says those groups provided a safe space when she was a student and helped cadets excel. The U.S. Military Academy disbanded the groups to comply with President Trump's executive order to remove race and sex-based preferences across the federal government and to combat diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in the private sector. Trump says DEI policies undermine national unity and the traditional American values of hard work and individual achievement. Dowdy sees it differently.
I will honestly say it's the good old boy system. Someone has a problem with people of color excelling. To me personally, I feel like it's all about making America white again.
It's a reminder, she says, that when there's progress, there's pushback. She and other activists gathered recently at the Alabama State House in Montgomery to build on the power of having more representation in Congress.
I'm going to say we, you say fight back. We,
fight back.
We,
fight back.
We fight with our vote.
The new congressional district is energizing to Jamori Gaucher, a senior at Alabama State, a historically black university. He sees it as an opportunity to have his voice heard and hopes having a 39-year-old black man in Congress might show other younger voters that participation matters.
Sometimes when I talk to some of my peers, it seems as if, you know, they feel as if their vote does not matter, you know, and choose not to exercise their right, feeling as if they have no power.
Gaucher runs a faith-based nonprofit in East Alabama that offers scholarships to minority students and is funded partly by federal grants. Grants, he fears, are in jeopardy as the Trump administration slashes government spending. Gaucher says the future is uncertain and nerve-wracking.
It seems like the ultimate goal is to make the rich richer and the poor poorer, you know. And so I feel like that's an attack on the freedoms of people who are often marginalized.
A single vote in the House of Representatives can really impact the outcome of what a four-year cycle looks like for families.
Evan Milligan is the named plaintiff in the redistricting lawsuit. He says having another congressional seat that gives Black voters an opportunity to elect a candidate of their choice is promising, but he's also realistic about the potential for political influence given the current climate.
It represents an opportunity, but it comes at a time where, there's a lot of things in the air. What looks to be an administrative coup, you know, the importance of having more representation at a time when the idea of representation is being undermined. That's a really important thing.
Sitting on the front porch of a community center he runs in a former church, Milligan reflects on how Montgomery has long been at the center of the struggle for racial equality.
The development of civil rights in this country and civil liberties is a big part of who we are in this district, certainly.
The history is all around. The former slave market near the Alabama River, the steps of the state capitol where Jefferson Davis took his oath as president of the Confederacy, and the spot where Rosa Parks refused to yield her bus seat. Milligan says staying engaged in the struggle is key.
I think we have to believe in ourselves and believe that collectively we actually not only can resist, but, you know, over time transcend the direction that some are pulling this country in right now. And that's a very difficult thing to do, but it starts with the hope.
Back in Mobile, two retired women are working to get more people active in the democratic process. They've invited me to a street corner on the north side of town. Traffic whizzes past a vacant lot, a couple of convenience stores, and a boarded-up beauty salon.
What we're looking at is, I think, a community that has a great need.
That's Beverly Cooper, who, along with Amelia Bacon, founded Stand Up Mobile, a voting advocacy group that tries to show people how voting can bring about change in neighborhoods like this. The women say the work is vital today as they worry the federal guardrails and safety nets erected to protect African Americans are being dismantled.
Once you start removing those things that people have relied on since the 60s, you're dealing with some territory that's really frightening to Black folks.
You know, if I could just say, all right, folks are going to be fair, then fine. You know, that we don't need all of these levels of protection. But we know that's not the case.
Bacon and Cooper are in their 70s. Old enough, Bacon says, to remember pre-Civil Rights America.
Because let's face it, there is a playbook. We've been on this road before.
And Bacon says they're willing to use it to keep fighting for the constitutional rights guaranteed to all Americans. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Mobile, Alabama.
This is NPR News.
R&B singer Ledisi is out with a new album. Its uplifting lyrics have earned love from the likes of Michelle Obama and Alicia Keys.
It's like, oh, we need this now. Everyone needs this. Okay, this is why I do music, to make people feel better.
Her 14th album, she says, has hope in every song. Hear some of them tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. For the first time in Australia, millennials and Gen Zers will make up the dominant voting bloc.
What could that mean for the results of the national election?
They are concerned about the state of the global economy. They've endured a pandemic.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. A federal judge in Texas ruled today that President Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act to detain and deport certain Venezuelan immigrants from South Texas is unlawful. It's the first time a judge has ruled the nearly 200-year-old law cannot be used against alleged gang members. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran has more.
The Venezuelan men in this Texas case have been threatened with imminent removal under the Alien Enemies Act. They're accused of being members of Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan gang that the president describes as invading the United States. U.S. District Judge Fernando Rodriguez Jr., a Trump appointee, wrote the administration does not have the authority to detain the men. That's because the gang's criminal activities, while harmful, do not constitute an invasion or predatory incursion understood under the Alien Enemies Act. His decision covers all of the Southern District of Texas, which includes Brownsville, McAllen, and Houston. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Austin.
U.S. factories are in a slump as managers struggle with the president's new tariffs. And Pierre Scott Horsley tells us about a new factory survey from the Institute for Supply Management.
The president's tariffs are supposed to help domestic manufacturers, but factory managers say they're having the opposite effect. New factory orders and output were down last month, while prices and delivery times were up. Managers say supply chains have been paralyzed by the size of the import taxes and the confusing way they keep changing. Tim Fiore, who oversees the monthly survey, says factories had been on the cusp of a boom before the president launched his trade war.
That's the sad thing, that we could be on a growth profile here, if not for the administration trying to change the way the entire world does business.
The trade war is also hurting factory exports as other countries look elsewhere for manufactured goods. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks were up on Wall Street. This is NPR. May Day. Protests across the U.S. are drawing tens of thousands of demonstrators. NPR's Windsor Johnson is in Washington, D.C., where protesters use International Workers' Day to call for social justice and comprehensive immigration reform.
Isabella Cabrera is a 22-year-old college student from upstate New York. She says she's furious about how the White House is handling its crackdown on non-citizens, especially those who are living in the country on a legal basis.
I have a lot of family that are Hispanic, and I am also Hispanic, and this scares me not only for my family but for fellow Hispanics.
Peter Fontenot is from Springfield, Virginia. He says the Trump administration is failing to uphold the Constitution.
They're thumbing their noses at one of our foundational documents.
Other demonstrators came out to demand an end to immigration raids and efforts to bust up unions. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Well, those small, cheap parcels from China will no longer be duty-free. That means higher prices for U.S. consumers and delivery delays when the government starts collecting those tariffs or taxes on every single shipment. Many U.S. companies that have built their products on sourcing from China will have to rethink their business model. Stocks finished higher after better than expected profits from Microsoft today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The White House has already made a lot of changes to how the government spends money, slashing the federal workforce and putting entire agencies on the chopping block. But soon we will get a glimpse of what else President Trump wants to do when the White House releases its annual budget proposal. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben is here in the studio to explain why this year's budget may be more consequential than most. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Danielle, what can you tell us about what we expect the White House to release?
Well, we expect something soon, but details are still sketchy, but it could be what's known as a skinny budget. Mm. Now, that's a sort of outline that presidents sometimes release before they release those big, thick, full budget books.
Right.
Often a skinny budget gives us just the broadest strokes of how much money is going to go to each department or agency. X billion dollars for defense, X billion for housing and urban development, and so on. Now, these skinny budgets from President Biden and also from Trump's first term, they've only included discretionary spending. So that leaves out the big ticket items like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, not to mention revenue projections. Now, that's a big omission because those safety net programs make up a solid majority of federal spending. But we'll get the White House's outlook on all of that when they release a full budget. And right now, we don't know when that's coming.
But then Congress has the power of the purse. Mm-hmm. They come up with the spending bills, as we both know. So how much does the president's budget actually matter?
Well, it matters, first of all, in the sense that it's required by law. Now, beyond that, most years, reporters like me will tell you that the budget matters because it's a list of the president's priorities.
Right.
It's his wish list, or as people say around Washington, it's a political document. Mm-hmm. But budget experts have told me that this budget may be more meaningful than usual. I talked to Jessica Riedel. She's at the right-leaning Manhattan Institute. She's also done fiscal policy for two Republican presidential campaigns. What she said is that Trump just right now has this huge amount of power over Congress.
The president has a tighter grip on the Republican Congress now than he did in 2017, which may make Congress more likely to stick to the president's proposals when they're writing a budget.
Now, Trump not only has Republican majorities in both houses, albeit slim majorities, he also has a stranglehold on the GOP. He's remade the party. He throws his weight around in primaries, and members of Congress know that.
I mean, this White House and allies of the White House have spent just a lot of time talking about cutting spending, including with the effort led by Elon Musk, known mm-hmm. as Doge. How does that fit into all of this?
You know, I asked Riedel about that, and she said that's another reason this budget might provide more insight than in a typical year.
Doge has already begun enacting spending savings that are supposed to go through Congress unilaterally. And the president's budget may essentially provide a preview of what Doge will attempt to enact unilaterally, even if Congress doesn't act.
So, Danielle, tell us, what will you be looking for in this year's presidential budget?
One thing is a split between defense and non-defense spending. Trump cares a lot about defense, so does he up that spending? Mm-hmm. And then in turn, does he propose cutting things like scientific research, the National Weather Service, the Education Department, which he has said he wants to get rid of? But that said, a skinny budget would leave open some big and important questions. For example, on entitlements. Here's Joel Friedman at the left-leaning Center for Budget and Policy Priorities.
The president has said he doesn't want to cut Medicaid, but Congress is now in the process of putting together this package that has a large, very deep cuts in Medicaid, threatening health insurance for millions of folks. So the question is will the administration embrace that as part of its budget proposals?
So even after all of this, there's going to be a lot more budget news to watch this year.
That's NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben. Thank you.
Thank you.
A record 18 million Australians are registered to vote in Saturday's national election. And for the first time, younger voters, as in millennials and Gen Zers, will overtake baby boomers to form the dominant voting bloc. Christina Kukolia looks at how their participation could shape the outcome.
Hey, TikTok. Thought I'd hop on here to let you know the big news we're announcing today.
I know my first TikTok is supposed to be something fun, and I probably should say something that is or isn't demure.
Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese of the centre-left Labor Party and the Conservative Opposition Coalition leader Peter Dutton campaigning on social media, a key election battleground this year for the country's two major political parties. To win votes, they're turning to influencers, memes and popular podcasts, like this one hosted by Abby Chatfield, a former reality TV star.
So I'd love to know, what is the difference in policies, just some examples, between the Coalition and Labor?
But those who've studied Australian elections say they're playing to a demographic with a very different political outlook. Nearly half of the 18 million eligible voters in this year's election are under the age of 45.
I simply want to take the power away from the biggest parties, if possible, and hand it to smaller party if possible.
First-time voter, 19-year-old Melbourne-based university student Tomislav Krivacevic says he's disenchanted with current Australian politics.
You always remember the worst things that you see about politicians. So you have this general mantra that they're maybe not following your best interests.
Analysts NPR has spoken to warn young voters are looking to alternative political parties, the Greens and independent candidates, which could deny an outright majority in Parliament to either Labor or the Conservative bloc.
These generations that we're talking about, Gen Z millennials, are going to behave at this election in a very different way than, I would say, older Australians have in the past.
That's Kos Samaras, the director of the Redbridge Group, an election research agency.
They are less inclined to support established institutions. They are a lot more inclined to be attracted to anti-establishment movements. They've got little faith in the major parties coming up with solutions with regards to the challenges they're facing as a generation, particularly around housing. And so they're effectively the drivers.
And what they care about, polling suggests, includes climate change, employment and healthcare. Kos Samaras says more than ever before, young Australian voters are also worried about the global impact of US policies.
They are concerned about the state of the global economy. They've just endured a pandemic. They are living through an inflationary crisis. And now they think that the world economy is going to get a lot worse and they will be the ones who wear the cost of that.
Research by the Redbridge Group shows the Conservative Opposition Coalition has lost ground among millennial and Gen Z voters, reflecting a trend of them turning away from centre-right parties. And days out from the vote, the incumbent Labor government is ahead in the polls and leads with young voters too. Duncan McDonnell is a professor of politics at Griffith University and co-author of a study into Gen Z voting behaviour. He says political messaging to young Australians may not be hitting the mark.
We know a lot of young voters in this country make up their mind the day of the election. But the simple fact is that we found that almost half of them go to vote because they're afraid of being fined. It's compulsory voting, as we have in Australia, that is getting them to the ballot box.
However they vote in Saturday's election, young Australian voters are starting to change the country's political landscape. For NPR News, I'm Christina Kukolia in Melbourne.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump has suggested that the tariffs he put in place on most imports from China might come down from the base rate of 145%. But as of now, they are still in force. And among the many businesses impacted by this are businesses in the country's Chinatowns. Many of them rely on Chinese imports. Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman from member station KQED brings us the view from San Francisco's Chinatown.
By all appearances, it's a normal day here in Chinatown. Street performers busk for tips, tour guides lead groups through the narrow, brick-lined alleyways, and Bay Area locals get their grocery shopping done. Daniel Young lives in Antioch and comes here to buy Chinese products he can't get anywhere else.
Today I bought some chips and a whole bunch of fortune cookies.
I even got a giant one for my daughter for her birthday.
He says he's noticed that some items are more expensive than they used to be. He chalks that up to the tariffs imposed by the Trump administration.
It's kind of like trying to start a war, you know? I don't understand why he would want to do that only to China.
Mei Zhu owns the store where Young was shopping. She says the vast majority of her products are imported from China. Soy sauce, dry noodles, candies, and cookies. According to Zhu, wholesalers have absorbed some of the price hikes, so she's only had to raise her prices by around 50%. But other items now cost a full 145% more, so she's stopped stocking them. It is extremely significant, she says. The higher prices are driving customers away, and sales are down 30%. She says it's already impossible to continue, and if the tariffs stay in place, she'll close her business. Down the street at Yongfeng Highway Chinese Herbal, Sam Leung presides over a store full of things like goji berries and ginseng and other products used in traditional Chinese medicine. He says you can get some of these things outside of China, but they may not be exactly what his Chinese customers want. And he's worried the increase in prices will put them out of reach for his customers. These Chinatown businesses are facing an existential threat, according to Malcolm Young.
This has always been a community built around trade.
He's the executive director of the Chinatown Community Development Center. He says for over a century, Chinese immigrants here have leveraged their connections back in China to build successful businesses and achieve their American dream. The tariffs are changing that.
You're basically just sending the signal like, that's off, that's done.
He says San Francisco's Chinatown has been around since the 1800s and has withstood all kinds of hardship. The Chinese Exclusion Act, the 1906 earthquake, and more recently, COVID and a local increase of anti-Asian hate crimes. Still, with this particular challenge, he says there's an emerging sense of powerlessness.
That these things are being done to us and that there's nothing, you know, we can do as a community to push back or fight back, but just to simply react.
He expects that other Chinatowns across the country will be experiencing the same kind of economic upheaval. Price hikes are also being reported in Chinatowns in New York, Philadelphia, and Honolulu. For NPR News, I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman in San Francisco.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. From the ashes of World War II, President Harry Truman presided over the creation of global institutions that still define the international order. But 100 days into his second term, Donald Trump has moved aggressively to scale back the U.S. role in the world based on his America First agenda. Here is NPR's Greg Myrie.
President Truman spelled out his doctrine in this 1947 speech to Congress.
It must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation.
In just a few short years, the U.S. helped establish and lead the United Nations, NATO, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. Democratic and Republican presidents have supported these institutions for generations. They sometimes grumbled at the cost, yet believe these organizations strengthened the U.S. as the world's leading superpower. President Trump sees this web of alliances, treaties, and soft power as expensive, outdated relics that restrain America's ability to act decisively on its own.
I'm not aligned with anybody. I'm aligned with the United States of America and for the good of the world.
Hal Brands at the American Enterprise Institute puts it this way.
If I had to boil it all down, I would say Trump's goal is to extract more privileges from the international order while bearing fewer responsibilities for upholding that order.
Trump scaled back U.S. global commitments in his first term. Now he's launched an even more ambitious effort. Kelly Grieco is with the Stimson Center.
In the first term, I would say the defining characteristic of his foreign policy was chaos. This time, he's really taking a sledgehammer approach to U.S. foreign policy and the institutions around it.
Trump is acting on all fronts, military, diplomatic, and economic. With the U.S. military, Trump wants to end U.S. involvement in open-ended wars, like the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The signature moment so far was his White House shouting match with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Of the war,
you're not in a good position. You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having
cards.
Right now, you don't have your playing cards. You're playing cards. You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III.
The president opposes further U.S. military assistance for Ukraine and wants a permanent ceasefire. That's proving elusive as Russian leader Vladimir Putin keeps up sustained attacks. Stuart Patrick is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
He's underestimating often his adversaries. He seems to believe that Vladimir Putin is going to be satisfied with only 20% of Ukraine. This is the appetizer course as far as Vladimir Putin is concerned. He wants the entire meal.
A ceasefire would give Trump some cover to pull back in Ukraine and perhaps Europe more broadly. But if the war carries on and Russia makes further gains, Trump could look weak, unable to stand up to Russia. This would raise even more questions about NATO's future and the U.S. willingness to defend Europe. Again, Hal Brands.
I think that NATO will survive a second Trump presidency. I think there will still be a NATO and the U.S. will still be a member of it. But I don't think that any European country will want to be as dependent on the United States in the future as they were in the past.
On the diplomatic front, Trump is pursuing several high-stakes deals. It's still early, but so far he has no major successes. An Israel-Hamas ceasefire, reached as Trump entered office, has collapsed. Talks with Iran on a nuclear agreement are ongoing. Kelly Grieco applauds the diplomatic effort, but is critical of Trump's belief that all this can be done quickly and without allies.
In many ways, he overestimates American power, and this leads him to this more bullying approach because he thinks the United States is so powerful that our allies, inner adversaries, will have to give way.
This unilateral approach to diplomacy is also evident in Trump's trade policy. He's destabilized the global economy with actual or threatened tariffs against virtually every country. Trump's main target is China, yet his go-it-alone approach has antagonized friendly countries that could help in a collective effort to isolate China. Here's Stuart Patrick again.
If you're going to be trying to press China on a number of different fronts, you would want to do it with allies.
For 80 years, the U.S. has underpinned this global order. And Hal Brands says there's still no other country that can do it.
And so if the United States says that it's going to stop being a global public goods provider and simply take benefits out of the system, I don't know how long that system is going to last.
President Trump seems determined to find out. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
This morning, nominations for the 2025 Tony Awards, Broadway's highest honors, were announced. The nominees included stars from movies and television, along with Broadway legends. While Broadway box offices are approaching pre-pandemic levels, fewer shows are making money. So the showcase of the national Tony broadcast is an invaluable marketing tool, says reporter Jeff London.
The producers of Buena Vista Social Club, Death Becomes Her, and Maybe Happy Ending are rejoicing today as their musicals picked up 10 nominations apiece and will be featured on the Tony broadcast. Rounding out the category are Operation Mincemeat and Dead Outlaw, a musical which already picked up several awards when it was presented off-Broadway last season.
Your mom is dead. Your daddy's dead. Your brother's dead. So are you. Abe Lincoln's dead. Frank James dead.
Revivals of the musicals Sunset Boulevard, Floyd Collins, and Gypsy will be happy too, as they received multiple nominations. Audra McDonald, who stars in Gypsy, picked up a record-breaking 11th nomination.
You'll be great. Gonna have the whole world on the plate.
This season, one of the biggest news items is the appearance of Hollywood stars on Broadway and the high ticket prices being charged. While Othello, starring Denzel Washington and Jake Gyllenhaal, was completely ignored, George Clooney, who stars in an adaptation of his own screenplay for Good Night and Good Luck, got a nomination. That show brought in close to $4 million last week, a Broadway record. There's a good chance that a first-time Broadway playwright picks up a Tony. English, John Proctor is the villain, and O Mary are up for the award, as is Purpose by Brandon Jacobs Jenkins, who won last year. More concerning are some of the shows not nominated for the biggest award, among them Boop, Real Women Have Curves, and Smash, which have been struggling at the box office. The Tonys will be broadcast on June 8th and hosted by Cynthia Erivo. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Put your ears on and let's burn this bandstand.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today, so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR.